This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Want to know how many buildings on Fayetteville Street in Durham were demolished in 1970? Or what Haytai looked like before the freeway? Or where the best swimming holes in Durham were 20 years ago? Gary Kieber wanted to know all that and more, so he started the website Open Durham. It's an interactive history of Durham that indicates maps, narratives, and pictures, and even more than that. It evolved from Gary's earlier blog, Endangered Durham, and it informs the work he does as chief operating officer of the development company Scientific Properties. Gary Kieber joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the program. Good to have
thanks,
you
Frank. Thanks for having me.
First, there was Endangered Durham. Why did you create that blog?
I created it because I had a sense that we were losing a lot of historic structures without a sense of why they were important, the stories they were associated with, and the continuity, the continuum of demolition that occurred over 50, 60 years in Durham. As someone who did not grow up in Durham, came to Durham later, I had to do a lot of self-education about that in order to learn about it. And I realized that there were a lot of other people who had come in the last 4, 5, 6, 10 years and didn't know that the Washington Nuke Hotel had been here, that entire neighborhoods had been east of downtown. So that was the impetus to start to tell those stories and make people aware of the full context of demolition. And when you made one demolition decision, where did that sit in the continuum?
And how did you get interested? Because you're from New Orleans. Your introduction to Durham was as an undergrad at Duke. When you went back to New Orleans, went to med school, back to Durham to practice medicine. How did you get interested in buildings and our history?
Yeah, I bought a little house in downtown, a tiny little mill house, which was surrounded by the freeway on three sides. Don't know why exactly, but it really appealed to me in the way that houses sometimes do. And I started just with trying to answer the question of how did this 1901 little mill house get surrounded by all of this asphalt? And that was what led to my interest in understanding the history of Durham. And that really grew from there into a coalescence of a couple of different interests around landscape sprawl. You know, South Point Mall was being built around that time. My own patients were struggling to find places to walk and exercise. And all of that really pulled together in a fascination with landscape and architecture.
Of course, that freeway, 147, played a very important part in the displacement and the history of Durham.
Yes, definitely.
So now Open Durham evolved from Endangered Durham. Explain that, describe it, and the mission of Open Durham.
Yeah, so Endangered Durham is a blog, and a blog is essentially a serial that you write at whatever pace, and I generally did write something every day for 5 years, and I never intended to do that for that long, and really the compulsion got the best of me, and eventually I created this archive of 3,000 to 2,600 buildings, and a blog doesn't function well as an archive, so I started to look at ways to translate it into a database where that people could really answer the kind of questions you outlined in your introduction without sort of having to just go through Google and try to do that. But they could actually ask them and map those interactively. The tools had evolved a great deal in the 5 years. The other really important component of it I want to do that I didn't anticipate when I started the blog was the comments were amazing. And the comments were far more interesting than anything I had to say. And that I'd get people that were a really diverse in every way group of people that would come on and write these long paragraphs about, I remember my mom would take me down to Crabtree and we'd buy a soda and we'd do this and then I'd sit on the wall by the church. And, these stories are amazing. And so what I really wanted to try to do is create a collaborative effort where people could contribute their own stories and histories. And it was not just one person or one professor with a grant or something else that basically says, I'm going to tell your story. But that there's an amazing array of viewpoints about any one place, down to a movie theater or a drugstore or a church or what have you. And the story of that is really told through a diversity of perspectives. And that is what brings – that's what enlivens it, as those stories of how people live their lives there.
What's nice is you've got collections of comments and individual recollections, but also a very good summary. If you go neighborhood by neighborhood and you want the full story, you can get a little summary or a full story. There's a real nice recitation and a history of the neighborhood. You can click on the building and see the building. You can hear about the neighborhood, look at the neighborhood, and again, see it on the map, which is always – and you hate that. So we were studying in school, and they talk about Mesopotamia, and you're thinking, where is that? And they wouldn't say, now? Well, it's where Iraq is today. So it's nice to see what that intersection, what's going on there today with the photo that might have been taken in 1901.
Yeah, it's a great sense of continuity, and that's what particularly as we understand sort of our future and how we build new places or how we rebuild places that have been abandoned or disenfranchised, what have you. What models, what can we draw? You know, what mistakes do we not want to repeat? What mistakes, what things worked that we threw away because we didn't understand them? And I think there's a neat study there in terms of understanding how an urban fabric looked when walking was the primary transportation. And so I really like that as a guide. And really, we've gotten to a point with the technology that's available to the public that we can describe this in great detail and depth. And what's really exciting to me is that just recently, Facebook, LinkedIn, all these sort of social networks, we've come to the point that we're describing relationships between people now and relationships between people in place. Well, we can do that with history as well. So there are various things out there that are mapping, linking, doing these kinds of projects, but really making a really hyper integrated, linked project that discusses, well, here's everywhere that my grandmother worked, and you can really look at all the employees of this company and where was that company located, and you can begin to understand the fabric of life in this really interesting way that really hasn't been possible before the last couple of years. So it's exciting.
And the continuity and correlations. I think part of our problem in interpreting history is assuming that that was then, this is now.
Right.
Segregation, thank God that's over with.
Right.
I guess there are no racial conflicts or discrimination. Right. Well, wait.
Right.
And you can see those correlations when you make comparisons between
right.
those neighbors. And especially in a city like Durham, which is such a crazy quilt with these little neighborhoods that have all
right.
been nestled and cut off and cul-de-sac. I mean, Crest Street neighborhood, for instance, is a fascinating place. And to learn more about it, maybe you can tell us a little about Crest Street, that neighborhood in the Hickstown
area. Yeah, Crest Street is fascinating because it is a successful uprising.
Yeah.
A successful power of the people to, who had seen essentially – because the freeway stopped first at Chapel Hill Street, then at Irwin Road in the 1980s, times had changed a bit, and people had understood that the promise of urban renewal and the promise of the freeway, et cetera, wasn't really all it was said to be. And so a really great coalition of people were able to come together and relocate the families in the neighborhood, rebuild the neighborhood to the Southwest. There's some loss there still of the old housing stock, the old housing patterns, et cetera. There's still the separation that the freeway engenders between that neighborhood and the area to the north up by Hillsborough Road. But it's a great example of, learning and taking different actions and really holding people accountable to, for the unfulfilled promises.
Yeah. Yeah. As you said, that freeway certainly did displace a lot of businesses,
yeah.
particularly black-owned businesses and families. But there was this one little success story
in
that whole essentially terrible story. And you just finished mapping Haytai. What did you find out that surprised you about that?
Well, it's really amazing to see the diversity of housing and how I think we tend to think I shouldn't generalize, but I tend to think or have thought of Haytai is somewhat uniform in terms of the way the housing might have looked, or Fayetteville Street certainly was different with many businesses as well as East Pettigrew Street, but you really get a sense in having read the urban renewal record. And having read some of the verbiage about my favorite phrase is functionally obsolete, which I may be functionally obsolete any day now. But it can really be a grab-all category for anything. But the housing, there were houses that probably were terrible. And really, those houses were not a loss. I mean, there were houses there that were they were still outhouses in 1960. They were falling down. They were rental houses who were in terrible shape. And way that it was gone, that occurred was poor. But it wasn't a big loss to lose those housings. There were amazing houses. They're mm-hmm. beautiful houses that are equal of any beautiful neighborhood in Durham. And particularly it's interesting in the context of Rolling Hills and discussions about rebuilding that area, to look at the geography of it and see the interesting fact of economic segregation by elevation that even occurred in African-American neighborhoods. So the places with the nicest views had the nicest, largest houses. So as you wound up Pickett Street, up to the top of that hill, it was just beautiful houses, beautiful Trinity Park, you know, sort of level of houses. So,
well, and the development that's gone on and the preservation in recent years anyway, in the whole triangle, in particular Durham, has been amazing. Scientific Properties has been part of that Golden Belt development on East Main Street. What's the latest? Any new projects in the works?
Well, we're still leasing up and building out Golden Belt and Venable Center on Roxborough and East Pettigrew. And, that's been going very well. We're opening a cafe in January and a hair salon, insurance agent. We've got Dog Star Tattoo, Show Door Educational Foundation have all just opened up in the last few months at Golden Belt. So we just leased up a space that has been vacant and Venable for quite a while. So things are going very well with that.
Smaller-scale projects going well. Bigger-scale projects kind of on hold because the money's tight?
Well, yeah, and it's just not the right time. You know, the larger-scale projects with Heritage Square and the Van Allen or Elkins Chrysler spot were really slated to be very large urban, you know, projects that would be many-storied buildings, lots of office space. And there really aren't the companies out there looking for that much space right now.
Gary, great to talk with you. Thanks for being
great
on the program.
Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Gary Kieber is Chief Operating Officer of Scientific Properties and founder of Open Durham, an interactive website you can find at opendurham.org. Coming up after a short break, Oakwood, how Raleigh's historic neighborhood saved itself. Find out on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.